Nick DiGilio here. We are live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of Trim Tower. Monday morning, and that means we have Monday morning movie reviews with Eric and Colin, and we'll take a look at the box office as well. And then my dad will tell a joke, jokey time. And we're going to talk about the best TV and movie fathers in honor of Father's Day, which was yesterday. But let's get the guys on. Here's Colin. Hey, Colin.
Hello there.
And here's Eric.
Hello.
Hey, Eric. So, Eric, I understand you're in Vegas.
I am.
How often do you go to Vegas? Is it like every week?
No, it's not every week. It's actually been almost a year since I've been here, believe it or not.
Wow.
So how time flies. Yeah, it's been, I think I was here last August or late July last year, and that was the last time I was here.
Wow. Because, I mean, you go there a lot.
Yeah, no, we take family trips here every year, and then usually some friends of mine get together, and we usually come out here, and I've been out here by myself, too, so, you know, two or three times a year, and I'm here this time for a friend's birthday. She's actually never been here to Vegas, so we're celebrating that.
Yeah, but now when you go, you spend an excessive amount of time there.
Yes. Yes, I do. 5-6 days usually.
Jeez.
were you getting the when you weren't going there last winter or whatever, were you getting the shakes? Were you getting a little a little bit of withdrawal there?
I do get the DTs. I have to check myself into a clinic. An anti-Vegas clinic and whatnot. But once you book the trip, the DTs go away.
Oh, good.
You know it's coming. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Yeah. So you get your
leave and they start all again.
Do you stay in the same place every time you go?
Most of the time, yes. I would say 70% of the time. Sometimes other hotels out here give me better offers, and I'll go to whoever will do that. But most of the time recently I've been staying at the Excalibur Hotel. They usually give me the best rates out here currently.
Okay.
So Eric is doing his Vegas thing. Eric, how many times have you been to Vegas?
Oh God, Colin, I don't know. I've been to Vegas more times than anywhere else, certainly. There was a time where I was going 3-4 times a year. You go back, especially when Cinevegas was happening. So, Cinevegas was one trip. Then I would have another family trip that summer. And then I had friends that would come out here in December for the rodeo competition. I'd come out with them just to hang out with them for that. Probably 3-4 times a year on average, I would come out here.
Right. Right. So the reason I'm saying that is because you're to Vegas for maybe your 100th time in your life or something, and I will be seeing you 2 5 times this week. So, we're both doing what we do this week.
Yeah. We're both doing what we love.
Movie. Exactly.
Wow. You're going to see them 5 times, Colin?
5 times. They come here Wednesday, the 24th. And they're doing 5 shows in Chicago between then and July 2nd. So they'll be around town all week, just, hanging out in Chicago. So,
jeez.
Who knows? They might do a show in between that, like a surprise gig somewhere. You never know. With this tour especially, it's been very unpredictable. So,
okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk about the box office, guys.
Yeah.
Man, Jurassic World.
Yeah, very crazy. I don't quite understand it, actually.
It's insane.
Yeah.
This week it made $102 million. What did you guys think?
I thought it was, it pleased the 8-year-old boy in me who loves dinosaurs, put it that way. If you want to just see dinosaurs fighting and eating each other, the movie delivers on that, I think, pretty well. But then when you stop and think about it, it's not that great. It makes a lot. It makes some mistakes. I mean, just in the characterizations and you know, some of the stuff the characters are supposed to do, particularly Bryce Dallas Howard, who's been getting her casting and her character has been getting a lot of controversy, especially, I mean, in the wake of, you know, Mad Max Fury Road, which I saw for the fourth time today. you know, it's just female characters need to be, you know, paid a little bit more attention to now, especially in the wake of that film. So a lot of movies are going to seem pretty weak by comparison. But, you know, it unfortunately repeats a lot of too many of the same things from, you know, the last few films. You kind of know where some of the action scenes are going. But I think some of the action scenes are pretty well done. I like the pterodactyl scene. I like the scene with the dead dinosaurs attacking the two kids and the spear thing. Even though it's reminiscent of the original Jurassic Park, I thought it was pretty well done. But I think for the most part, I look at it and I kind of think that this might, I mean, these grosses aren't going to change anything for how studios pick their directors. But it does seem like it's directed by a guy who just isn't ready for this kind of a film yet. This is directed by the guy who did Safety Not Guaranteed, and I thought, which is a movie that I like a lot, but you don't watch it and you think, well, this guy should direct dinosaur films. It's sort of like Spider-Man, directed by the guy who did 500 Days of Summer, the Spider-Man reboots, I should say. And I really don't like those movies at all. And I kind of think sometimes these directors are being picked a little too quickly to do these kinds of films. But I feel like they should be doing a bridge film, much like, you know, Nolan went from Memento to Insomnia, and then he did Batman. You know, he had the Insomnia between there, which I think some of these directors could benefit from to give them a little bit of practice.
Eric?
I agree. The one point I definitely agree with on Colin is that the movie is very reminiscent of the first Jurassic Park, and it seems that the movie is it's showing its reverence so much to the original film that it never breaks free, so to speak, to become its own movie. I mean, all the action scenes are incredibly reminiscent of other action scenes in the series. And not one of them has, like, even a single bit of original inspiration to them. I mean, you think that, you know, a guy like Trevorrow would just kind of jump at the chance and just the opportunity to just design a really interesting action sequence. You know, maybe he might not succeed with it, but at least it would be something different. You know, by the time you get to the end of this movie and the climax is virtually identical to the original film, you kind of wonder, like, well, did they just remake this movie, the original movie, and not really come up with anything new here? And I think that's almost the case. I didn't really have any expectations going into the movie. And when it came out, I had even less. I didn't like it when I saw it, and I liked it even less the more I thought about it. Colin's absolutely right about the Bryce Dallas Howard character, and man or woman or whatever. You just got to write a character a lot more interesting than that. Especially if you're going to just have her be the prim and proper, you know, female, you know, bitchy type who, you know, halfway through the movie has got to jump up and then, you know, show that she has boobs, basically, which is kind of what her character does. Her dress gets ripped, you know, enough throughout the rest of the movie that by the end you're just kind of like looking at a body rather than a person. And while that's visually pleasing to the male sect, it doesn't really make, you know, much when you, like Colin said, you've seen Mad Max Fury Road and what they do with the women in that movie. So I'm very disappointed in this movie. I'm disappointed in how much it's making, too, because now it's the highest grossing Jurassic Park film in the franchise, and it doesn't deserve it because it's the worst film.
Yeah. You know what? I didn't hate it because it's got dinosaurs eating people and fighting.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I want from a dinosaur movie. It's not very good, though, and I agree with you story-wise. And it is sort of, I mean, it is sort of a carbon copy of the first one and also has elements of the other two sprinkled throughout. You know, there's not original bone in its body, but it's got dinosaurs eating people.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I didn't like Lost World very much, but there's nothing in this movie as good as the Jeep going for the cliff scene in the Lost World. So, you know, it's got that movie has a slightly upper edge, and that movie's not that good.
Actually, Lost World is the favorite of the series.
Yeah.
Of the series.
Yeah.
I know.
We know that, yeah.
Weird.
Yeah.
Number two is Inside Out, which made $91 million. How is that for a Pixar opening?
That's the second best Pixar opening of all time. What was the first? Toy Story 3.
Okay.
So it's actually the most money made by an original Pixar piece by over $20 million. The Incredibles was the previous winner in that regard, and not only done $70 million. Monsters University did $82 million. So $91 million for a movie like Inside Out is actually quite impressive.
Yeah. All right, we're going to review that a little bit later. All right, guys, hang on.
All right.
Yeah. All right. Eric and Colin are here. And we're going to review movies and finish up the box office right here on 720 WGN. Nick DiCilio here. We are live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trip Tower. And we are reviewing the new movies and checking out the box office with Colin and Eric. And let's bring them back. Here's Colin. Hey, Colin.
Hello there.
And Eric. Hey, Eric.
Yes.
All right. So Jurassic World number one, Inside Out number two. Number three, Spy, with $10 million, bringing its total up to $74 million. Is that considered a success, Eric?
I think it eventually will be a success. Not the great one that they were probably hoping for, not certainly as much as Bridesmaids or The Heat did in the U.S. or internationally.
What did The Heat do?
$158 million, I think.
Wow.
158, 156. Yeah, it was a big success. And Bridesmaids, I think, did 160-something, 161, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Spy, you know, which I kind of thought that, you know, I think the last couple of Melissa McCarthy movies are what hurt this movie more than the quality of this one. Because everyone seems to really like Spy. We all liked it. And just people are just... I don't know. I mean, if anyone who saw Tammy or Identity Thief probably thinks that she's doing the same old shtick, and I think that might have hurt this one a little bit.
Okay. All right. Next, in number four, is San Andreas with $8.2 million, bringing its total up to $132 million. Is that underperforming?
No. That's an absolute success. That's solid money here in the States, and it's doing even better business worldwide. So that's a success for Warner Brothers and The Rock.
Okay. And number five is Dope, which made $6 million. And how is that?
Well, that's sort of an interesting story. I think people might look at that and go, like, well, that kind of underperformed. But you have to understand that was a pickup from Sundance. And movies, you know, Open Road has only picked up three movies from Sundance in their brief, like, 4 or 5 year history. You have to consider that even last year, there were only three movies last year that made more, that Sundance pickups that made more than $6 million at the box office total.
Wow.
And, you know, one of those is Boyhood, and that, I don't even think that should count because that was a special screening at Sundance. The other two were A Most Wanted Man, which was coming off the passing of Philip Seymour Hoffman, so there was a little bit of built-in interest in that one. Mm. And the other one was Whiplash, which at the time that it got all of its Oscar nominations had been out for 14 weeks, and at that point it only grossed $6.1 million.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. So, and it only ended up with like a little over $13 million. So you have to consider that Open Road, like, actually, like, taking this movie wide, you know, I kind of applaud them. I say good for them because, you know, any other studio probably would have taken this movie and platformed it, and then if it didn't do well on, you know, opening weekend of one or two, would have just buried it, and the thing would have ended up with a profit or like a gross of like $1.5 million, if that. So I applaud them for actually taking a chance and going wide with it and, you know, making $6 million off the box. Maybe, you know, it'll turn into a little word-of-mouth hit.
Colin, you're the only one who saw it.
Yeah.
And you're going to review it in a little bit, okay?
Yeah.
All right, cool.
And I'm with Eric on this. I'm glad they're taking it wide. I mean, it's the kind of movie. I mean, you know, we're gonna. I mean, I'll talk about the movie itself, but it's a great move on their part for African American audiences to give them some, you know, to put a movie like this out there in such a manner and to get into, you know. You know, get its audience in the door, so someone at the hunt for it, and looks like they turned out. I mean, you know, well enough, and I think I think this movie could have legs through the summer.
Well, it's got strong word of mouth, and it's getting pretty good reviews.
Yeah. So, and when the preview audience I saw it with were definitely eating it up and just having a great time with it. So.
Okay. Number six, Insidious Chapter 3, $4.1 million, bringing its total up to a little over $45 million. Now, how does that rank with the other Insidiouses?
It's certainly less than the second chapter, which had a really boffo opening weekend of like $40 million and ended up grossing $80 million. And the first one grossed, I think, $54 million. It was kind of a word-of-mouth horror film. Hit, which you don't really get a lot of. So this one had like a decent opening, and then as expected, it kind of died off. But it's a very small budget movie, so that movie is already well into profit.
Okay. Number seven, Pitch Perfect 2. Man, what a success this is.
Yeah.
$3.3 million, $177 million. I mean, it's actually way outgrossed the first one, right?
Oh, yeah, almost three times as much. The first one grossed $65 million, and you have to sort of look at the year that Universal has had. Universal reached $1 billion in gross here in the U.S. faster than any studio in history this year, thanks to not just Pitch Perfect 2, but also obviously Jurassic World, Furious 7, and 50 Shades of Grey. So that's the year Universal's having, and they still have Ted 2 and Minions on the horizon.
Wow.
So they're very happy over there at Universal right now.
Okay. Number eight, Mad Max Fury Road, $2.8 million, bringing its total up to $143 million. Shouldn't the numbers be a little bit bigger on that?
Yeah, it should be. I mean, if anyone that, you know, has been listening to us or any of the reviews, you would hope that they would have, you know, I know it's R-rated and all, but that they would have taken a hint. I mean, it's actually sort of like the big word-of-mouth hit of the summer, in a way, compared to what it started with. So, I mean, it's a success in that regard. I'm just kind of surprised that the international numbers have not been a bit larger, considering the international pedigree behind it, and considering that China ate the hell out of Furious 7. I don't know why they wouldn't, you know, be just as interested in a much better movie about cars chasing each other. You know, there's still hope that it's going to turn a profit for them, but right now it's still kind of lingering in the red.
So, Colin, you saw it for the fourth time.
Yeah, and I'm a little surprised by international numbers, too. I mean, this is the kind of movie that you know, should do well because it's not based, you know, it's not solely an American product that only interests Americans. You know, it's placed in, you know, somewhere, Australia, I guess. You know, it's the kind of movie like Star Wars that should, you know, work, you know, across all continents, and you know, should be, you know, a bigger than just a word of mouth hit. It's kind of surprising that the numbers aren't bigger on this movie, and I'm not just saying that because I love it. Just seems like the kind of movie that would, you know, have a long legs through the summer, all over the place. So maybe it's, I don't know, for here, maybe it's the R rating, but for everywhere else, I'm not sure why.
Do we know how it's doing in Australia?
I'd have to look at the specific international numbers. You know, I'd like to think that it hasn't even opened there yet. Maybe that those are the numbers we're waiting on to get it pushed over. But if you go to Box Office Mojo, you can actually find a breakdown in the foreign listing for Fury Road of exactly what it's done per country.
Okay.
It looks like it's opened everywhere. According to IMDb, it's opened in Japan this weekend. But it looks like it's opened everywhere else. So,
well, Japan numbers, there are a lot of numbers to be made over there, so that could be a good thing for them.
Number nine, Avengers, Age of Ultron, with $2.7 million, bringing its total up to $451 million. How does that compare with the other Avengers movie and some of the other superhero movies?
Well, in the U.S., $450 million, a disappointment for Avengers, because the first one did over $600 million, but it's something like, I think it's close to $1.4 billion worldwide, including the U.S. numbers. So that's good enough for, I think it's fourth all time right now.
Wow.
So fourth or fifth.
Wow.
So they're not complaining over there at Marvel. They're fine with those numbers.
Number 10, Tomorrowland, with $2 million, bringing its total up to $87 million. And this is considered a bomb.
Yeah, this is the bomb of the summer. Actually, I think the bomb of the year, or one of the bombs of the year. Disney, they're already prepared to take a $120 to $140 million write-off on this movie. So it's a real disappointment for them.
Yeah, I'm looking at it. The budget for it was $190 million.
Yep.
And it's now up to only $87
million. Yeah, and I think it's just about that much overseas, too. So I don't think even over the overseas money it's even reached that $190 yet. So, yeah, this is a pretty tremendous loss for the Disney people.
Okay. So, again, number one, Jurassic World, man. I mean, like, seriously, insane numbers for this movie.
Yeah, it's going to approach Titanic numbers. That's what we're looking at.
Wow.
Oh, man.
Really crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not even a movie that, you know, is going to be widely, you know, revered throughout the year. I mean, it's just people are just seeing it. But nobody, is it a lot of repeat business on this movie, or is it just everybody?
Honestly, Colin, I think what it is that, I mean, remember it was like about 2 years ago that the Jurassic Park 3D came out, you know, and that was sort of at the tail end when they were, you know, they were still sort of interested in doing these 3D re-releases, and it did fairly well. It grew like $44, $45 million just in the re-release. I think the Jurassic Park thing in the franchise has just become one of these movies that has just sort of been passed down to the next generation. So you have a whole another group of, you know, kids interested, obviously, in, you know, dinosaurs eating people. So I think that, you know, this is a movie that, you know, they weren't, you know, like, you know, what do you want to see, Tommy? You want to see Tomorrowland or Jurassic Park? Oh, I want to see Jurassic World. So they wait, you know, to see that instead. So I think it's just sort of a generational thing that there's just a whole lot of people out there, like, this is going to be their movie. So
yeah, you are right.
And in the same way.
Yeah, you're very right in that kids are always interested in dinosaurs. Like, that has never waned. That makes sense.
Okay. My friend Scott Oaken went to go see Jurassic World, and he posted on his Facebook page, Jurassic World better than Citizen Kane.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. Oh, okay. It has its fans.
Okay. I expect more from Scott. Yeah. I'll just say that.
Yeah. All right, guys, hang on.
Okay. All right.
All right. We got Colin, we got Eric, and we got more movies to review coming up right here on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio here. We are live in the Allstate Studio on the 7th floor of the Trip Tower. It's Monday morning, and that means it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews. We just went through the box office. Colin Suter, Eric Childress from eFilmCritic.com and RogerEbert.com join me every Monday morning. Colin, welcome back.
Hello there.
And Aaron, Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. Colin?
Yeah.
Tell us about Dope.
All right. Well, Dope was, this is the film, it's a film that takes place in the inner cities of, I believe it's Los Angeles. It's about a teenager named Malcolm, played by Shameik Moore, high school senior who, you know, just wants to go to Harvard. He has two friends, and they're all, the three of them are sort of considered the geeks in the school. They're sort of like sci-fi geeks, except they're all obsessed with 90s hip hop. And Malcolm even has a kind of a kid and play haircut that's, you know, very, very 90s.
The high top fade.
The high top fade. That's, okay. Sorry, I didn't know that. That's what it was, the actual name of it. I just refer to it as the kid and play haircut because I think that's where it started. Or that's the most popular version of that, I guess. All right, so thank you for schooling me on that. I'm so white. they're also a punk band. So they don't even like play 90s hip hop. They're a punk band, and given the couple of songs that they play in the film, I would definitely buy their album if they had one. It's pretty damn good. So anyway, Malcolm and his friends, they spend a good deal of time trying to avoid dangerous parts of their school and their city. But one day Malcolm can't really escape it, and he finds himself being the messenger between a drug dealer and the drug dealer's ex-girlfriend, just sort of passing notes back and forth between the two of them. And the next thing he knows, he's going to a party put on by this drug dealer and coming home with a backpack full of drugs after a big shootout, not knowing how they got there. So he's got to figure out what to do with the drugs, give them back, sell them. And while trying to make the right decision, he finds himself in very unpredictable sets of circumstances that result in drug overdoses, car chases, more drug dealers, and even computer hacker who helps him with the very innovative plan that could result in a very favorable outcome regarding his future. So it sounds almost like an urban risky business, only instead of pimps and hookers, it's drug and drug dealers. And it's not too far off, but this is definitely more comedic and broad than that film was. This is a very unpredictable, very funny movie that also delves into, you know, things about black culture that have come up in conversation and vernacular over the last few years with regards to, you know, Trayvon Martin and things like that. It doesn't do that quite as successfully as it wants to. I think there's a point in the movie in the third act where it is very, you know, blatant about its message, and yet it's a message that's kind of awkwardly delivered. It's not part of the movie that I didn't feel like the movie was building up to it. Just sort of there it was. It's not the final moment of the film, but it is a moment in the film that, you know, it sort of breaks the fourth wall. And, you know, it's an attempt at a statement that is potent and should be made. But I think the movie needed to do a better job of working up towards that and make it a little less awkward. When it happens, like I said, the audience I was with, you know, cheered big time. So it's definitely strikes a chord and hits a note. But I think the cast is very winning. I think the leads are really terrific. The comic timing is really good. Some of the scenes I think get a little predictable, run maybe a little bit too long. But it's a movie where it's consistently, I mean, it's very entertaining. You never know where it's going to go. And I think this, like I said, could be, you know, sort of a sleeper hit of the summer. I think it should be. I think it deserves to be. This is a Sundance discovery that I think, you know, should be discovered more broadly. And I don't think it's just, you know, a black audience should go see this. I think all audiences could get something out of this and have a lot of fun with it. So this is a movie that I definitely recommend.
Okay. That's dope. And Colin recommends it. All right, guys, hang on.
All right. Mm-hmm.
All right, Colin and Eric are here, and we've got more movie reviews to do right here on 720 WGN, so stick around. Morning. Nick DiGilio here on a Monday morning. That means it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews. We're in the middle of doing them right now. Colin Suter and Eric Childress join me every Monday morning to review the movies, and let's welcome them back. Colin.
Yes.
And Eric.
Hello.
Eric, tell us about Heaven Knows What.
Okay. This is a film about junkies. It stars a woman named Ariel Holmes, who was a real-life drug abuser on the street. And this is kind of an autobiographical tale that she stars in and also penned. And this movie is, you know, has sort of an aimless quality to it, in that it's a movie about junkies and their life on the street and where they're getting their next score from, and this sort of this really tense and unhealthy relationship that she has with another fellow drug user who sort of professes his love by trying to get her to commit suicide. Lots of laughs in this film. But this is a film that sort of has a sort of one of those more interesting backstories more than what we sort of see on screen. What we see on screen is, while not necessarily bad, sort of a familiar kind of trope that we've seen, you know, movies about junkies, and, you know, we've seen movies like this before. And there's actually another movie that I don't think is playing in Chicago anymore, unfortunately, but it was called Animals, and it ended our film festival last year, that I think is a much better movie about sort of a rocky relationship on drugs and hustlers living on the street and whatnot. But the backstory of this movie, the directors of the movie, Joshua and Benny Safdie, found this Ariel Holmes on the street and somehow struck up a friendship with her, some respect, and actually got her to pen her own autobiography, which I guess is yet to still be published. And once she sort of did that and turned that in, they then turned that into this movie, basically. And to me, you know, sort of the idea is like, this movie doesn't really sort of have any kind of arc into, you know, where this, you know, where this girl came from and, you know, where she's going to end up. And, you know, if she is, you know, so worthy of, you know, these writing talents that we hear about, how can the movie, you know, the story never, you know, delves into this aspect of her life? It just, it kind of gets to a place where it just kind of ends and you just kind of go, okay, so that's it. So it's not, like I said, it's not necessarily a bad movie. I mean, it's very well filmed. It's actually pretty decently paced. And it does have the funniest death scene of the year, in my recollection. But it's not a film that I wholeheartedly recommend, but I can understand where people are finding some power and courage in telling the story. I just think it's a film that we've seen many times before, and we're just not seeing a whole lot new in this one.
How is she as an actress?
Well, that's the kind of thing that, you know, as a critic, you sort of wonder, you know, when you see, you know, someone basically making their debut in film, and they're essentially playing themselves, especially, you know, playing a, you know, the junkie version of themselves that they used to be. You know, you just kind of go like, oh, okay, well, that's kind of brave, and she's probably, you know, maybe she's pretty good at it, but maybe that's how she just is. So, you know, are we watching a performance, or are we just sort of watching her recreate the moments of her life that we've seen before? So, you know, until I see her give another performance, it's kind of hard to judge exactly just precisely how good she is in this movie. I mean, she's fine. She's, you know, but I just, you know, until we see her do something else, what do we have really to judge it against?
Did you see this at a fest?
Yeah, it played Toronto Fest last year. That's where I saw it. It played our fest this year, and a lot of people responded very favorably to it. I thought it was a film that a lot of people were going to kind of look at, you know, some of us and kind of go like, "Ooh, that was a bit dark for my taste." But no, a lot of people really found a lot to take home from it. I didn't find as much, but you know, I'm more in the minority on this one.
Okay. I was playing at the Century Center Cinema at Clark and Diversey in Chicago. So if you want to see it, check it out there. All right, let's move on. On video on demand this week, but then opening at the Siskel Center next week, is a movie called Manglehorn. Colin, tell us about it.
All right, well, this is the latest film from David Gordon Green. And it is a character study, definitely, starring Al Pacino as a guy named A.J. Manglehorn. And he's a guy in a small town in Texas who runs a, he's a locksmith. He gets called in to, break people out of cars or whatever. It's basically a movie about his life. As he goes from day to day, he doesn't live with anybody except he lives with a cat that won't eat his food. So he has to have surgery. He goes to slot machines at night. He, eats at buffets. He's a creature of habit, definitely. But he's also writing letters or writing a letter. We're never quite sure until the end what's going on here. To this woman named Clara, who is a woman from his past that meant a lot to him, and he's basically writing love letters to her and wishing to see her again. He has a son from another woman who's a very successful investment banker, but they have a very rocky relationship. He does forge a friendship with a bank clerk played by Holly Hunter, and she's taken a little bit more of an interest in him than he is of her, although he's very willing to be her friend, but he's still hung up on this Clara person. And the movie just kind of, sort of meanders from one of these, relationships to the other in the way that David Gordon Green does. For people who don't know, David Gordon Green is the, is sort of the king of the directors. He makes movies that critics love that nobody ever sees. And that's definitely going to be true of this film. Even self-proclaimed film aficionados that I've met, when I name drop David Gordon Green, they don't know who I'm talking about. Until I mention Pineapple Express and, his mainstream outing is this trilogy of the great Pineapple Express, the not so great The Sitter, and the really bad Your Highness. Well, now he's going back to his indie roots, his last three films, and this is the third in a trilogy of films that he's been making, all within a few miles of each other in Texas. Prince Avalanche and Joe were all filmed within a few miles of each other. And this one definitely feels at home with those other two films. It'll be interesting to go back and watch all three of these in one sitting. How is this movie? I'm one of his biggest fans, and I just watched it tonight, and I'm still kind of wrestling with it. I'm not sure how much I like it, but I do like it. I think this is definitely one of his most experimental films. He definitely, he loves playing with the form of narrative where you're not quite sure what's happening in a scene until it's over, and even then you're not quite sure what it had to do with anything. There's a scene in this movie where Al Pacino is in a bank with Holly Hunter, and all of a sudden somebody comes in and is singing a song, and everyone just stops what they're doing and watches him, and then what happens later in the scene is very unexpected. And yet there's something about a scene like that in one of his films where it doesn't have anything to do with anything, but you can't imagine the scene not being there when you look back on the whole experience. It's an acquired taste. Not everybody's going to respond very favorably to this film. And not a lot of it works. There's stuff in this movie that doesn't work. The Holly Hunter stuff, it feels a little underdeveloped, maybe even a little forced. But I think it's always interesting to watch how Green experiments with his movies, and how sometimes the experiment works, sometimes he doesn't. But I'm glad he's back to doing it. I'd rather see him fail with something like this and fail with something like Your Highness. So this is definitely idiosyncratic. It's quirky to the point where people might be very put off by it. But I thought it was a very, very interesting film that I'm still kind of wrestling with.
Okay. All right, Colin and Eric. Hang on, guys. We'll get Eric's review of Manglehorn after we take a break here on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It's Monday morning. My dad will tell a jokey time coming up later. Right now, it's the Monday morning movie reviews with Colin Suter and Eric Childress. And we welcome them back. Welcome back, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
Colin just reviewed the new David Gordon Green movie with Al Pacino and Holly Hunter called Manglehorn. And now it's time for Eric to review it. Go ahead, Eric.
Well, I really quite like this movie. I think I actually like it more than Colin did. I don't think it doesn't quite stick the landing at the end, but that's really sort of the difference between a 3 and a 3.5-star movie. And I'm sort of right in the middle there. I think this is a very interesting film. I use the word aimless to describe the last movie I talked about. And you could certainly use that word here. And Colin used the word meandering. But I think, there's something interesting about this character and the way that that David Gordon Green is telling the story. Pacino gives a performance that, David Gordon Green seems to be on a career trajectory to sort of bring back really great actors from their over the top performances. He did it with Nicolas Cage and Joe. Although still did allow some bits in that movie. But here, Al Pacino's sort of playing a character that almost kind of going through his insomnia a bit in a way, which he actually has in real life. But this is the kind of movie that, can take you from that sort of that magical realism moment where the guy is singing in the bank to, step-by-step cat surgery to Pacino telling like the most horrific story about a child you can possibly imagine. I think that's sort of those leaps that the movie takes are sort of kind of the key to understanding the inner complexity of the emotional state of this guy, who this guy is. I don't know if we're meant to understand everything about him, but he's kind of a lonely guy. He sort of missed his opportunities in life. I actually really like the scenes between him and Holly Hunter, if nothing else for the reason that it reminds us just how great Holly Hunter can be in a role, and we need to see more of her. The date scene that they have together is one of the more uncomfortable moments I've seen in a film all year. And I like this movie. David Gordon Green, rarely does something uninteresting, especially when he's working with a movie like this. And I like this movie more than Prince Avalanche, maybe not as much as Joe, but I think it's worth taking a look at.
Okay. Video on demand this week and then at the Siskel Center next week. All right, cool. It's nice to hear that Holly Hunter is back on screen and doing good work. I love her.
Go ahead.
No, I see. She's really terrific in the movie. I just think her character is underwritten. But I do like the scenes between her and Al Pacino. I just kind of wish there was a little bit more meat for her character, so we'd understand her a little bit. But right. It's a movie definitely worth checking out.
Okay, next, Pixar's latest, Inside Out. Eric, tell us about it.
Okay, this is the story of what happens in all of our minds, specifically our emotions. As we see that when we're first born, we see the manifestations of emotions being also born within our own psyches. We see first the appearance of joy, then sadness, and then following up not too far behind, fear and disgust, and What's the fifth one?
Fear, disgust,
joy, anger, sadness, fear, joy, disgust, sadness. Anger. Anger.
Yeah, anger.
Of course,
yeah.
Anger. Of course, I should know that one. But this movie takes place mostly within the head of a young girl named Riley, who at the age of 11 is being forced, you know, to move. Her family is being uprooted to San Francisco because of job considerations. And she has to go from her, nice house in the suburbs to sort of a kind of a rundown, part of San Francisco, where she has no friends and she's not quite, her body's obviously going through some interesting changes, and her emotions are doing the best to sort of keep up with her, and sort of keep her memories fresh and to keep her the happy memories alive as opposed to the sad memories. At some point, her emotions in trying to manage all this chaos end up getting split. And joy and sadness find themselves in a completely other part of her brain, literally trying to catch the train of thought that is going through her head so they can get back to the control council where they can hit the right button at the right time and make sure that she becomes is as well stabled as possible. So you have, Pixar film that, it has, this sort of adventure quality to it. But this, the main characters in this movie are the emotions. And, this is something that is not new to Pixar in the way that they've sort of gotten within our, the audience's emotions with their films over the years. This film is directed by Pete Docter. And the last time he directed the Pixar movie, he gave us a 4-minute montage 10 minutes into the movie and had audiences all over the world crying 10 minutes into the movie. And, of course, that movie was Up. And here he takes a movie that could have been really silly. The previews sort of suggest that there's a lot more wacky stuff going on, and that really sort of worried me when I first saw the previews. But the truth be told is that Pixar is back. And this is an absolute masterpiece, one of the best films they've ever done, arguably the best idea they've ever had. And it's one of those rare movies, live action or animated, where it's seemingly every 10 minutes the movie takes you in a completely different direction and yet never, ever loses the essence of what this film is ultimately about. And to really to spoil the sort of the denouement of this movie, I would really be doing a disservice, but I think we're all probably going to have the same reaction as we discussed that if Up had you crying 10 minutes into the movie. The way I've been sort of describing this movie to people is that they save those 10 minutes for the last part of this movie, double it, and just hit the emotion buttons in all of our heads to such an extreme that it's impossible to not be shedding tears by the end of this film, which is not to say that it's not also an incredibly funny film. The voice work up and down across the board is terrific. Phyllis Smith as Sadness is great. Amy Poehler as Joy. Lewis Black as Anger is inspired. The great stuff throughout the credits. This is a movie that is going to stand the test of time as just one of the greatest creations Pixar has ever made. Just one of the best films, period. I don't care, live action, animated. We've said this as a broken record with Pixar before, but the last, three movies we've had from them have not really been up to their standards. But I say, and I'll say it again, Pixar is back in a big way, and this is absolutely one of the best movies of the year.
Okay, guys, hang on. We got to take another break here on GN. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Colin and Eric are here. We're reviewing movies. And Pixar's new movie is called Inside Out. We just heard Eric's review. And now we want to hear Colin. Colin Suter, Eric Childress, welcome back, guys.
Hello.
Thank you.
Colin, tell me what you thought of Inside Out.
Oh, wow. Eric is definitely right on with this. I echo everything he says. And the emotional aspect of it, I mean, the movie is about emotions, obviously, but one of the reasons why I think it touches a nerve with people is, we're not just crying because something tragic happened to the character that we really care about, But it's a movie about all of us. I mean, every one of us goes through this. And, I mean, meaning every one of us discovers, you know, gets to a point in life where we have to discover and let in the emotion of sadness. And this is a movie that touches on that theme so eloquently, and has taken such great care of making sure that it's a movie that's really smart and brainy, but not esoteric and off-putting, and that it's not going to go over people's heads, particularly young people. This is a movie, I think, you know, if you're a parent, you got to take your kid to see it. Definitely. If you're a teacher or a school social worker, you definitely have to see this movie, because it's basically sort of a gift to people in that profession who have to deal with kids who have social emotional issues. And it's a great way of using the movie to help kids understand their emotions when they can't understand them. I think this movie works wonders in just, being not just a great artistic triumph, but also a tool for teaching that is unlike anything, you know, that I've seen before for a movie about young people. And also being, on top of that, really funny and really inventive. The literal train of thought that we see, and you know what that train contains, you know, when they trip over a box and what's in that box, they go, what the heck? And you think about it, you're like, of course, that's what you'd put in a train of thought. I'm trying not to give away jokes here, but they travel into the subconscious and the dream world, and you know, you realize that what you're watching is an adventure film that is purely figurative. Everything you're watching is figurative. It's all a big metaphor, but so brilliantly executed as an adventure film with legitimate characters, every bit as legitimate as Toy Story or Finding Nemo. These are characters who are lost and have to get back to their destination. It's still a Pixar movie, in spite of the fact that it's dealing with all of these really abstract parts of the human brain that we all have, but we never really think about. And this movie that's definitely going to make you think about how you think and what you know and how you feel. And how many movies do that? I mean, I've been describing this movie as Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind for kids, because that's kind of what it reminds me of. It's not really about, you know, memory or anything like that, but it is about memory, but it's not about relationships, I should say. It's not a romance movie of any kind, but it definitely has that Charlie Kaufman quality of you're being written and produced by somebody who really thinks about this stuff a lot and put a lot of care into the execution of it so that it's really entertaining. This is kind of a miracle, really. In every regard, this is a movie miracle. Not something I say very often, but it definitely applies here. And this is not overhype, and this is not, this is not hyperbole, critics, and, you know, us overselling it. This is a movie that I think I'm so happy it's making the money it's making because it deserves it. This is a masterpiece, definitely.
Yeah, I'm with you guys. It's a phenomenal movie. It's the best Pixar movie since WALL-E, easily. And it is hilarious, and it is beautiful, and it is touching, and it is incredibly cerebral. And I'm obviously that's a
yeah. I mean, to the point where I thought it's so cerebral that I wouldn't be surprised if it was Pixar's most grossing film. But I'm so glad I was proven wrong on that this week.
Yeah, no, it's great. The characters are really memorable. All of the emotions. You guys were talking about some of the voice work. It's great, and it goes to places that you don't expect it to go to, and it covers things that are really important and beautiful and profound. This is a very profound movie. But that doesn't mean it's not hilarious, which it is, and very entertaining on that wild, adventurous Pixar level. It's a phenomenal movie. It is one of the best movies of the year, without question, and one of the best Pixar movies ever. And that's saying a lot, considering Pixar has made so many great films.
Yeah, and I think this is a movie that I think, like I said, it's about all of us. And everyone's going to take something different from it. Everyone's going to have an emotional reaction to it. But I also think this is a movie that we're going to hear about it during award season, and not just for best animated film. I think this is going to have a lot more pedigree than that at that time of year.
Yeah.
And there's also kind of a almost like a chicken and the egg quality to the movie. The sort of the one thing that I kept thinking about after the movie is the idea is that, you know, are the emotions in the movie controlling us, or are we controlling our own emotions? And I think that's just one of those many ideas that the movie sort of touches upon, and letting you figure out the answer too. You know, this is a movie that, you know, Colin nailed it with all the people that sort of need to see this movie. But, you know, I'm not a parent, but, you know, if I was, this would be the first movie I would be taking my kids to and all their friends to, and then wanting to just see it for myself over and over and over again. I'm in Vegas, and I might see this movie again.
Got it.
Yeah. And I can't wait to see the theme park rides. Oh, that's going to translate, but no, that's it'd be interesting to see the kind of life this movie leads now that it's at past opening weekend. It's made all the money. It's, you know, made $90 million. It'll be interesting to see the trajectory of success afterwards. I'm very curious to see what happens with this film.
Yeah, I think it's got legs, and I think it's people are going to embrace it and love it, and it's going to be considered a Pixar classic years later. I really do. It's a great, great movie. Inside Out.
And we all cried, correct?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh,
so,
yeah. I've seen it twice, both times.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it doesn't matter if you see it in 3D or 2D. I saw it in 3D. It really didn't, you know, add anything to the experience or take away anything. Just see it however you got to see it.
I saw it in 2D, and it was, you know, perfectly fine.
Yeah, me too.
So, all right, what do we got next week?
We got Ted 2. And we got Max, the army dog movie.
Oh, okay. Is he mad?
I don't. Maybe. Maybe. We'll have to see what the emotions in his head look like.
Yeah. Okay.
Maybe he just has anger.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll talk to you next week. Are you up, by the way, Eric?
I'm not anything. I got here today, and I've just been sort of playing tour guide to my friend's friend who's, you know, having her birthday. So I've just been sort of doing that. So I haven't even placed a bet anywhere yet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
How long?
I'm
you
down
there?
Dinner, basically.
How long are you there?
I'll be coming home on Saturday.
Jeez.
First thing Saturday. Yeah.
Man, that's
fun
a
time,
long
man.
Time.
Should get out here. No, it's not.
Gosh.
And when I talk to you next weekend, I will have seen my 30th YouTube concert. So
there you
wow.
go. There you go.
Yeah.
Colin, would you see you two in Vegas?
What's that?
Would you see you two in Vegas?
Would I see them in Vegas? Yes, I would have. Yeah. I would.
I think Colin would see you two anywhere.
I've seen them in a few different cities. Yeah, I've traveled.
Okay.
All right. Colin, Eric, thank you guys. We'll do it again next Monday.
All righty.
Okay, hang on, and we'll talk next week. That's Colin Suter and Eric Childress and for the movie reviews, and we'll do it again next week.